today with the September arguments. And I call case number 00-2467, Lori Hofflander versus St. Catherine's Hospital, Inc. et al. We have a schedule of the oral argument with 15 minutes for Mr. Nelson, representing St. Catherine's, 10 minutes for Mr. Hughes, representing Horizon, 15 minutes for Mr. Hirschman, representing Ms. Hofflander, 10 minutes for Mr. Aiken, representing the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers, that's Atticus, with whom Mr. Hirschman has shared his time. And then on rebuttal, we have 3 minutes Nelson, 2 minutes Hughes, and 5 minutes Aiken. Is that the lineup? Okay. All right. We hear first from Attorney John Nelson.
I'm John Nelson. I represent St. Catherine's Hospital, Century Insurance, and the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund, defendant respondents. The defendant respondents submit that the Court of Appeals misconstrues the import of Yankee versus Clark County and a line of authority on safe place statute that as such its decision raises mental health providers to the status of insurers of patient safety in mental health units. We believe this is inconsistent with repeated pronouncements of this court. The issues that I hope to address are care and custody under Yankee. I think it's Yankee. I think that's how we've been pronouncing. I'm never quite sure.
Well, we took a vote, and that'll be the one that'll
okay,
be pronounced
good.
Today.
Okay. Number two, application of the Safe Place statute to the facts in this case, and eventually the cross-appeal discoverability of JCHO surveys. First off, I wish to acknowledge that this is not an appeal of Yankee with respect to the employment of the reasonable person standard to Lori Hofflander. I don't believe there are any arguments in the trial court or before this court that Lori Hofflander fit within the Gold or the Bruning exceptions such that we believe Lori Hofflander should be judged in contributory negligence to the reasonable person standard as enunciated in Yankee. There, I don't believe either that there's a real dispute whether Lori Hofflander was the major cause of her own injuries and that her contributory negligence exceeded the negligence of the defendants. Likewise, I think it's really not in dispute that Lori Hofflander was not engaged in any act of intentional self-harm, which was the reason for her emergency detention and involuntary hospitalization. And lastly, I think there's no dispute that the plaintiff was not on either suicide or elopement precautions at the time of her injuries. I would like to acknowledge at the outset that despite my words in the brief, I believe that indeed following Yankee, that Lori Hofflander did hold a special relationship with St. Catherine's Hospital, because I think the clear language of Yankee says that a person involuntarily committed as a matter of law holds that status as a special relationship status.
Yeah, that was going to be a question I had, because I thought in your brief, and I may misinterpreted it, that you indicated that at the time of the escape that St. Catherine's did not hold a special relationship with Hofflander.
Well, Justice Wilcox, it was quite fuzzy in my mind, because although I concede that a patient involuntarily brought in, and in this case it was emergency detention, not an involuntary petition, but at the time of her elopement, we maintained, or I believe, that the reason for the involuntary commitment, meaning she was suicidal, had long since passed. She had been taken off suicide precautions.
Well, about 15 minutes before.
The day after. Yeah. Actually, she had been relieved of suicide precautions by Dr. Newman the day following her admission, so that would have been the 29th, and then on the 30th when Dr. Shaw again examined her, having read all the records, determined that she again was not only not a suicide risk, but that he was prepared to order a voluntary, change her to a voluntary admission.
Well, tell me what you think. Everything seems so jolly at the moment over what you agree with. What do you think the Yankee stands for in terms of what does St. Catherine's have to have foreseen that she was going to harm herself because she had been in on danger to self, that so they couldn't foresee that the particular injury, particular manner of injury, or the particular injury of escape, or the particular concept that she would escape and get injured on that. How do you apply Yankee here?
In my view, Chief Justice, the language of Yankee speaks to that, and that is the particular injury.
So you couldn't foresee that she was going to break her ankle? I mean, is that what you mean by particular injury, or break her back? Or do you mean that you couldn't foresee an injury while escaping, or you couldn't foresee an injury of self-harm?
I think, Chief Justice, that one must foresee an element of self-harm with a patient who is admitted involuntarily for suicide ideation or actions.
Are you talking harm in general, or, as the Chief Justice is pursuing you, a particular harm?
I am suggesting a particular harm,
okay.
And I think...
So if they could have foreseen a broken ankle but couldn't have foreseen a broken back, your client is out? Is home scot-free?
I believe I've tried to distinguish that based on the Williams article in the Nebraska Law Review that acts of simple negligence are different than acts for which the special relationship arises. In other words, I think Mr. Williams actually spelled that out, that if a patient in a psychiatric unit falls from a third floor window, the hospital might be negligent for allowing the window to be unlocked, but if it wasn't a suicide attempt for which the patient was admitted, he termed it simple negligence, for which contributory negligence should apply. And I think that's what I'm trying to...
I'm a little lost by that. As I see your argument, and you started out, you know, whether or not there's contributory negligence, whether or not as a matter of law she's more negligent or not, that almost becomes irrelevant. That what's really in play here, you are arguing, I understand it, is the care and custody. Because care and, it's not care and custody, what is it, custody and control. Because if you fulfill the two requirements of custody and control, that overrides any duty on behalf of the plaintiff to exercise ordinary care. Is that your, am I correctly understanding your argument thus far?
I think that's correct.
Okay,
yes.
So then we talk about the two elements of custody control. Number one, special relationship. You've acknowledged there is a special relationship.
Yes,
so what we're really talking about is number two and how Yankee defines it. Now, whether it's a particular act, as Justice Babbage was indicating, or a more general. And you point to the language in Yankee. But there are several places in Yankee that talk about a more general foreseeability requirement. Paragraph 97, that's a hospital's under no duty to take a special precaution when there is no reason to anticipate one's patient's escape or suicide. It doesn't say any particular manner or mode. The same is true with a general description, could have foreseen escape attempts in paragraph 95 as well as in paragraph 91, duty to prevent a foreseeable escape attempt, general. But you rely instead on paragraph 93 that talks about particular injury. How do you reconcile that different language?
Well, quite clearly the Court of Appeals felt the more language, the language of propensity or proclivity, seemed to fit given the language in Yankee.
Now, that's the way the jury instruction committee interprets Yankee also, isn't it?
That is correct. It is.
But they talk about citing Yankee in determining whether the employees knew or should have known. That's the foreseeability, the possibility that the plaintiff would injure himself or attempt to escape. So that they define it more generally, not like you're defining a particular manner or mode. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So it's your position, obviously, that they're in error, that it should be more narrow and should require a particular manner or mode of foreseeability. Is that correct?
That's what I believe, that we should have a greater degree of foreseeability of the injury that actually occurs.
Well, particular injury, you're saying.
Particular injury.
And you're talking about manner and mode of how it occurs.
Yes.
That's your argument, as I understand it.
That's correct.
Well, I guess my question, by particular injury, are you meaning a particular injury to an ankle as opposed to an ankle as opposed to a wrist, or are you talking about a general injury?
I'm talking about a general injury.
Okay.
That
a general
is,
particular.
That there is foreseeability that an event of a certain type is likely to happen.
Well, here you're talking about, no, she wasn't, she came there because she was suicidal. Basically, that's what we were looking at. We were not looking at elopement or escape. That's what you're talking about here, right? In other words, we didn't think, or we should not be held liable because she, on her own, tried to leave the premises.
Correct. We believe rationally and with a plan, as in Yankee, that she executed
yes.
the plan, which was not suicidal in nature.
And that's the injury you're talking about, if I believe you're talking about. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Let me try it differently. In this case, St. Catherine's was aware, well, let us assume that St. Catherine was aware that this patient had suicidal tendencies and had to be checked for that. Okay?
Correct.
And I think that was true here. Now, suppose instead of an escape, she tried to commit suicide by jumping out of the window, removes the air conditioner, and just hops out, saying, "I want to die." Everybody can hear her say that. Right? Got my
yes.
new fact situation? All right. And then is injured. Doesn't die, but is injured. Would that fall within Yankee as an injury that would overcome contributory negligence?
I believe so, because that's why...
So what?
That was the reason, the acknowledged reason, why she was involuntarily committed.
So you interpret Yankee, if I understand you, the hospital has to be aware of what the potential danger of this patient is. Suicidal, might hurt others, wants to escape. There may be others, but those are three that come to mind. And if the hospital is aware of which of these three, or a combination of all three, right? And then the patient does it, then you have overridden contributory negligence. But if the hospital is watching for suicide, there's no reason to think this person is going to escape. But then escapes, the hospital is not liable.
Yes, then I believe...
That's your position.
I believe the contributory negligence should be imputed with a comparison between
and
the
so
negligence of the hospital.
And so your foreseeability is to the nature of the patient's... danger, the
yes.
nature of the patient's problems.
Yes, I believe that's right.
To guard against those, so it doesn't matter if she breaks her arm or foot or something else.
Correct.
That isn't the issue.
It's not whether she breaks.
Relates to the why is she there and what are they watching for.
Yes.
Now the amicus takes the position, and I'm just looking at page 11, that that the caregiver received notice of the patient's inclination, propensity for suicide slash escape slash harm. And they make the point, now, is it rational for any person, and they seem to use the word delusional, for the Spider-Man to go out of a third-story window, and it's a direct, I mean, it's right down to the street level, I take it, and tie a rope around her ankle, and then they'll think that she's escaping. I mean, she could just as well have been trying to do away with herself. I mean, that's the issue that we don't know, right? We don't know for sure.
Justice Wilcox, I think we do know in this case, because Lori Hofflander's own testimony was quite specific that I wasn't attempting suicide. I had my plan. I know it sounds foolish now, but, you know, I thought it out.
And that's what the amicus says. Is it rational? It was it delusional for her to think that she could escape in the methodology she used by tying, you know, even tying it around her ankle. So you end up, if you tie it around your ankle, well, you'd be upside down. Anyway, my vision is you'd be upside down, dangling, if the sheets would have held. But in any event, that seems to be an argument that they're making, that it does. Regardless.
It does, however, I think the facts rebut that in this case, that she was delusional. I think this was a carefully concocted plan by Larry Hofflander. I think the facts have borne that out in the record. And that's what makes it such an unusual case.
The proof is kind of in the, what is that, the pudding they say or something like that. And I never knew what that meant. But it sounds to me that the argument in the amicus that she ties this rope to her ankle might not be delusional, but sure sounds crazy. Doesn't it to you?
It's not something I would do, hopefully.
Is that
the standard? But then again, you know, I think you can make that same argument about, you know, is suicide rational? I think in certain cases, suicide is completely rational. I don't think because the manner in which she chose to elope might not sound completely justified to each of us as reasonable persons. I mean, I'm projecting onto her the same thought that she should have, and then we said open and obvious, quite clearly she confronted a known danger in doing so, which she admitted. And that's what's unusual about this case, because we don't have the mental capacity issue, either factually or legally, I don't believe.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 3 minutes to Mr. Hughes, you represent Horizon Mental Health Management.
Yes, Your Honor. John Hughes. I represent Horizon Mental Health Management and its insurer, Columbia Casualty. And just to follow up on one point that was mentioned, in terms of the rationality of the plan, she also had called an accomplice to pick her up, to meet her on the ground. She had both tied the rope to break any potential fall. And if there was a problem with their rope, she had somebody there. Someone was coming to assist her. The plan really was thought out, I would submit, more than Mr. Yankee's plan of going hand over hand across a ledge and then scaling down a wall. The amicus uses the term Spider-Man, and I would submit that would apply more to Mr. Yankee.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
About Lori Hofflander's other problems, her drinking problems, her drug abuse. Does that change anything about her status?
Well, when she came in, that was why she came in. That was why she was chaptered, because she was under the influence of drugs and alcohol, a combination of drugs and alcohol, Your Honor. She cleaned up. I mean, these things got out of her system. The idea, I think it's crucial, Your Honor, on this idea of her status, to remember that we are dealing here with a patient in a hospital with an attending physician. This woman was seen by her attending physician the morning after she was admitted. The attending physician said, she's no longer suicidal. Take these suicide precautions off of her.
Didn't he preface it, or she preface it with saying when the patient stabilizes,
no,
to that effect?
You're confusing that with the physician at the end, Your Honor. That was the one who used the term stable. That was Dr. Shaw the next day. Dr. Shaw saw the patient
within an hour
of the time she went out the window.
Right.
Dr. Shaw saw this patient, said, and did two things. He both said she can convert from chapter to voluntary. He also lessened her medication. In two ways, he lessened the level of restraint. He used the term stable, that's true, but what he meant, and he testified to this, is that his conversation with Ms. Hofflander angered Ms. Hofflander. She showed some anger at him. That is why he sent the nurse down to check and said, you know, just make sure she's calmed down and she isn't angry anymore. That was the nature. It wasn't beyond that. It was anger. That was what the stability went to. When the nurse came back, Dr. Shaw was still there. He's standing at the nurse's station writing his order. That's when Ms. Hofflander came up and said, I'd like my makeup. That's when Dr. Shaw said, no glass. But no glass, as the testimony shows, is the policy for everybody. It was not something specific to Ms. Hofflander because Ms. Hofflander was a risk. It was a general policy for all the patients that they were not to have glass. And he was simply reminding him of that. The nurse reported to him the shoelace incident. He knew, obviously, about the glass. He knew all of this material. All of these things that we say, or that some argue, quote, the hospital should have known. The attending physician knew. And the attending physician stood there knowing it all and wrote an order, lessening the restraints on her in two ways. Now, the hospital staff did not have any greater knowledge than the attending physician. He knew what they knew. To argue here for the plaintiff's position is to argue the fact that, to make the statement that a nurse should have overridden the attending physician without any greater knowledge than the attending physician had. Plaintiff here chose not to sue the attending physician, not to accuse the attending physician of being negligent in writing that order, in lessening those constraints. That's the fact of this case. I'm sorry. That's the fact that we're dealing with here.
I have a question for you. One of your arguments is that regardless of St. Catherine's liability, you, Horizon, are not liable.
Well, one of the things...
And now I'm hearing from you, because you're management, one person, et cetera,
right.
Not
visit,
right. Patient care.
Right.
Now I'm hearing from you, you're not liable because the physician might be liable. If anyone is liable, it's the physician, and you're not liable for the physician. Is the physician an employee of the hospital?
No, it's a private attending physician.
All right.
He is not. This is a private hospital, private unit. This is an outside attending physician with staff privileges. He's a psychiatrist. And on the Horizon point, you're right. I believe Horizon is also not liable for additional reasons. None of this information that arose in the last hour of her hospitalization, which is the focus of all the activity here and all of our inquiry here, was known to Horizon. Horizon wasn't present. There's no dispute Horizon wasn't present. The appellate court seemed to, I don't think there's any dispute Horizon is an agent. They were contracted, they were given authority by St. Catharines, were limited job at St. Catharines to do this management activity. you don't imply the knowledge of the principal to the agent. It goes the other way. If the principal has agent, it has a certain amount of knowledge.
Your position is Horizon was the what, principal or agent?
Agent.
Has your position changed from one court to the other?
Pardon me?
Has your position as to whether it was principal or agent changed from trial court to court of appeals?
I know, I saw that point here, and I didn't have the record. By the time I saw it, I didn't have the record. Not that I recollect, Your Honor, but I could be proven wrong by a written transcript. I mean, I simply don't remember. But that's my position here. I mean, I think it's clear.
So you're the, again?
The agent.
Agent, okay.
We are contracted with St. Catherine for the specific purpose of management of the unit.
Well, just because the principal is liable doesn't mean the agent is not.
It doesn't mean the agent is or isn't. Absolutely. We look to the facts of the case. Absolutely, Your Honor. My point here is, though, that the knowledge of the last hour is not, you don't impute knowledge that the principal has to the agent. It flows the other way. The agent's knowledge gets imputed to the principal.
I don't want just to continue on this, but all of the policies that were used by St. Catharines were set out by Horizon. In other words, the policies for security, elopement, etc.
Not quite, in the sense that this unit pre-existed Horizon. I mean, there was an inpatient behavioral medicine unit before Horizon ever came. So there were pre-existing policies. When Horizon came, Horizon obviously had a lot of influence and being experienced, talked with them and revised, suggested revision policies. They still had to be adopted by St. Catharines. They are St. Catharines policies. They had to formally adopt them like they adopt all of their policies.
In other words, the management was not truly the last word. In other words,
could propose policies. We could revise them and say, here, please adopt this. But, excuse me, it was still a St. Catharines Hospital policy, just like all of their hospital policies, and we go into their hospital policy manual along with every other hospital policy.
Mr. Hughes,
yes.
This is a multi-floor hospital.
Right.
But Horizon didn't manage the whole hospital, did it?
Oh, no, just part of one floor.
It only managed the third floor.
Right.
Give me an example of Horizon's management where it could have been found negligent in some way.
Well, I would think if Horizon came in and suggest that you not have a policy on elopement, let's not have it. And St. Catharines says, well, okay, we'll not have a policy on elopement. And then, there's an elopement. And that kind of stuff. Horizon is intimately involved in that situation being created. And I would think that they would have an equal liability with St. Catharines in that situation. If they have a role in that particular activity, yes. Here, the idea that in this last hour, something should have been done to heighten the awareness, that somehow the staff should have overrode the attending physician, when the attending physician knew exactly what the staff knew, and based on that material, should have done something different, I think has nothing to do with Horizon. Horizon didn't know any of it. Okay. They weren't there.
Your red light is on.
I understand.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hughes.
My name is Jerome Kearsom, and I represent Lori Hofflander. When I first learned of Ms. Hofflander's situation, it amazed me that a psychiatric patient in a locked psychiatric unit could get out of a window. And that was the reason I took the case, because it just didn't make any sense that something like this could happen, especially at 6 p.m. on a normal day on a psychiatric unit. as I explored the case and conducted discovery, I came to the conclusion that the only reason this happened was because of the negligence of St. Catharines and Horizon in failing to maintain their premise and failing to keep an eye on Ms. Hofflander per Dr. Shaw's instruction. And we find ourselves here today because the responsibility for her injuries has been laid at Ms. Hofflander's feet. And I think this case provides the court an opportunity to revisit Yankee, to fully address how people in protective custody should be treated in our tort system. There are very important facts which are ignored or misstated by the defendants, and they need to be addressed and acknowledged by the court. There are some things that we concede. She was in protective custody. We do not concede that drug abuse is what got her there. She was threatening suicide. She threatened suicide to her husband, ex-husband, to her friend and her mother, and all three intervened to have her admitted, and she was admitted on an emergency detention. Dr. Ilagan Newman did take her off suicide watch, but she diagnosed her as having dysthymia and borderline personality disorder. And so in her differential diagnosis upon admission, drug abuse was not part of the reason for her continuing to be there on a Chapter 51. We concede that she was told by another patient at least the day before that there was a loose air conditioner in room 309. Evidence in our mind of constructive notice. If a patient knows of a loose air conditioner, perhaps the facility should as well. Ms. Hofflander did not tell the staff about the loose air conditioner. She was there on a Chapter 51. She needed protective custody. She wasn't thinking right. She wanted to get out. And she told staff that on a number of occasions. She indicated that I could get out of here if I wanted. I could kill myself if I wanted. She was found with a rubber glove and threatening to put it around her neck, and that was taken from her. She was able to pull an air conditioner out without tools. This 100-pound woman was able to remove a 120-pound air conditioning unit on her own. We can see that.
Now, what's the negligence here, that they didn't check on her frequently enough and that they had a loose air conditioner?
Twofold, Madam Chief Justice. First, with respect to the nature of the premise, part of St. Catharines and Horizon's policy was to conduct environmental checks on a regular basis. There were set protocols for doing that. The person who, and one of the requirements was that at every shift change that there would be an environmental check. Rosemary Walden, the unit secretary, conducted that first check on the day of Ms. Hofflander's attempted elopement, just 2 hours before it happened. And she admitted in her testimony that she just conducted a head count that she didn't check for the environment. We submit that a proper environmental check would have revealed a compromised window, or should have revealed a compromised window. Secondly, that's the argument that goes through the premise. Our assertion of negligence is that they did not monitor Ms. Hofflander appropriately per the instructions of Dr. Shaw. I concede and acknowledge Mr. Hughes' statement that Dr. Shaw didn't write a note saying that we have to watch her, but we do have testimony in this record that Dr. Shaw told Nurse Witherall, watch her closely. Go down and check on her. And that was within 15 minutes of her going out the window. watch her closely. She goes down and catches Ms. Hofflander ripping up bed sheets to make shoelaces so that she can leave. Nurse Witherall does things appropriately. She takes the shoelaces away and the shoes away and returns them to the unit. She didn't remember where they were put. Shortly after that, Ms. Hofflander comes to the desk asking for makeup and the phone book. And Dr. Shaw says no glass, and she departs to the telephone room. Nurse Witherall is going on dinner break. She tells Nurse Martin and Martell, Dr. Shaw told us to watch Lori carefully. She's angry. She has just ripped up bed sheets to make shoelaces. She's in the phone room. Keep an eye on her. And she goes on dinner break. Nurses Martell and Martin deny getting that information. Either they don't remember getting it or deny receiving it at all. So we conclude one of two things. Either Nurse Witherall didn't tell them, or they're ignoring the fact that they did get that information. Immediately after that, Lori Hofflander steals into room 309, not her own room, only two doors down from the nurse's station. That's part of the record. The map or the layout of the floor plan is in the record. Two doors down from the nurse's station, goes to the window, removes a 120-pound air conditioner without tools. The framing rips out. It causes a huge crash. She leaves the room to check to see if anyone's coming. Now, this is after Dr. Shaw said, watch her closely. Nurse Witherall is at lunch. Nurses Martin and Martell are in the break room. Lori sees no one coming. She goes back in, ties the bed sheets together, one around an ankle and one to a windowsill that really doesn't exist, and attempts to leave. The first notice that the unit has is a call from another part of the hospital saying, are you missing someone? At 6 p.m. on this December 30th day, because we found someone in the bushes downstairs and you appear to have a window open on your unit. It's then that the unit secretary checks and they find that yes, there is an open spot, and we are missing a patient. Mr. Nelson conceded that there was a special relationship, and under Bianchi, there is a heightened duty of care at that point. And we get to the foreseeability issue. What was foreseeable? Lori Hofflander was volatile, abusive, aggressive throughout her entire stay. And all of that pales in comparison to what happened just the hour before she left. She meets with Dr. Shaw. She's sarcastic and evasive in that meeting. He says, we'll convert her to voluntary once she's stable, but she's not stable at that point, and he's not discharging her. He wants her to stay in the hospital, but on a voluntary status. She's found with the shoelaces. She's found at the nurse's station asking for makeup. And then the nurses are told, or are supposed to be told, keep an eye on her. And then within 10 minutes of that, she's out the window. At a minimum. I'm sorry.
Basically, what you're indicating is that this court should remand this back. I mean, that we're looking at a summary judgment motion, which was granted, and then was reversed, of course, by the was sustained first by the trial court, reversed by the Court of Appeals. But there are still these questions, material fact questions, that are hanging out there that you're, you know, indicating at this time.
Justice Wilcox, I agree. Under the Yankee decision, it's been my position throughout that these are issues of fact, although I move for partial summary judgment at the trial court, asking that the court find as a matter of law that her conduct was foreseeable in light of the facts that are developed from the St. Catherine's record itself.
Well, how do you define a Yankee in terms of a foreseeable issue? I mean, if the court should agree with you and remand this for trial, you still have to tell the trial court what Yankee means. Obviously, there's some dispute about what Yankee means.
Madam Chief Justice, we believe that, or we submit that the decision in Yankee tells what it means. It discusses Mr. Yankee's propensity to leave, not whether he would have left in this specific method. And the Honorable Mary K. Wagner-Malloy determined that St. Catherine's was free of liability because they couldn't predict that she would remove an air conditioning unit and go out the window in the manner which she did.
But do you agree that the institution had to be able to foresee either that she's an escape artist or wanted to escape, or two, she was suicidal, would harm herself, or three, she was a harm to others, or she was someone who had a combination of one, of two or more of those?
I agree under Yankee, Madam Chief Justice, that one of those things has to happen, that they have to be aware that there's something amiss with this patient. She's threatening to kill herself. She's threatening to leave. She's acting in a bizarre fashion.
And in what case, in this case, which is it?
She's acting in a bizarre fashion. She wants to leave. She's told everyone that she wants to leave.
I assume that, maybe it's wrong assumption, I assume that everybody who is institutionalized, involuntary, has acted in a bizarre fashion.
That's correct.
Otherwise they wouldn't get I
don't dispute that either. I think, and that's the reason they're there. And St. Catherine's and Horizon undertook the responsibility to protect those people.
So it's your position here that they should have known, one, she might commit suicide because she's so threatened, and two, because she was preparing her shoes so that that she might have escaped. And she was unhappy being there.
Well, with all due respect, Madam Chief Justice, I think it rises to the next level. Dr. Shaw and Nurse Witherell did what they were supposed to do. They checked on her and they recognized that Lori was someone who needed to be watched and tried to convey that information, and then it didn't happen. And so
they're negligent. Well, I'll give you that. But if this wasn't an institution and they were negligent in not caring for her, they were negligent in not having the air conditioner on properly, and she then pulled it out and jumped from a third story, by law, she'd be more contributorily negligent than they were, right? You got to get over that.
Outside of this protective custody setting, I agree. If it's a student at UW-Whitewater, pulls the air conditioner out of the dorm room, goes out, he's more negligent as a matter of law. I can see that.
All right.
A different situation, St. Catherine's Hospital, two of my kids were born there. Third floor is also OBGYN. What if a
mother jumped?
the air conditioning units at OB, if the institution is aware of a mom who is suffering significant postpartum depression, you know, maybe they got to be more careful in that setting too. But that doesn't rise to the level of Yankee because there's no special relationship there. And it would create a whole different set of circumstances.
But you're avoiding telling me what St. Catherine's had to know about her as to particularization in order to make them liable. Escape, self-destruction, destroy others, or something else. Maybe that I'm asking the wrong question. Then you ought to say that, too.
No, I think I understand your question, Madam Chief Justice. And St. Catherine's had to foresee conduct that Lori Hofflander would engage in that was going to be a harm to herself or other, be it by escape or or suicide, and they had that indication. And I think in adopting the foreseeability issue in Yankee, we have to look at what our court has done for decades in adopting the minority Paul's graph aspect of foreseeability. What St. Catharines and Horizon is asking is that we flip-flop and adopt the majority Paul's graph, holding that you need a particular foreseeability, that you have to see the harm coming.
And is that foreseeability question an issue of fact or law?
Well, this court found it was a question of, or it could be determined as a matter of law in Mr. Yankee's case. I think the flip side is appropriate here. You can find that foreseeability existed as a matter of law in Ms. Hofflander's favor.
And that's what you argued in the circuit court, that it should be decided as a question of law, whether there existed this heightened duty on the part of the hospital.
I asked the court to rule in that favor, but I also argued that in the event the court couldn't reach that conclusion, at a minimum, that this is an issue of fact.
And the Court of Appeals treated it as an issue of fact.
That's correct, Justice Sykes.
Okay, counsel. Thank you. You have no time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Aiken.
Jerry, could you just stop?
Good morning. My name's Tim Aiken. I think the problem that has developed is because the law has lost sight of its roots. The question was asked, the insane or lunatic is negligent. The simple fact is before Yankee, that was never the law. Crazy people could never be found negligent, period. What we have failed to do is distinguish the difference between holding a lunatic responsible, financially responsible, guardianship of Meyer, Gould, and the other cases cited in Yankee, and holding them negligent. It is interesting that over 120 years ago, this court in Caro, it's volume LV2, I can't remember from Market High, that I think that means 42. It's the January term, 1883. I have the site somewhere I can give the court. Held that, in that case, a lunatic cannot be held. And all the way up to the case of Brunig, this is post-Gould now, in 1969, oh, quoting Carl, I can give you the exact site. It's 57 Wiss 56 at 64. Brunig says, but it was said in Carl that an insane person cannot be said to be negligent. The cases holding an insane person liable for his torts have generally dealt with, and it goes on. The simple fact is that the public policy before Yankee was a public policy that although an insane person cannot be negligent, public policy says as between two relatively innocent people, let the person who caused the harm pay for it. And the court outlined, as was repeated at Yankee, the basis for that. One is, if it's a rich lunatic, why should his estate get to keep the money rather than the injured person? That the caregivers for the lunatic will not have an incentive to institutionalize the person, was another one, and the third was the idea that we want compensation for the injured party. Yankee reversed the public policy, assuming the lunatic could be negligent, and then said, well, let's apply, and to some extent Gould did the same thing, let's see whether or not we want public policy to bar that negligence. That's reversed. It's the old adage, bad facts make bad law. Yankee was a bad fact case. He was not hospitalized for his own safety. He brought about his own mental illness by not taking his medication. He's a completely different person than this lady.
Counsel,
but, yes?
I don't want to interrupt you if you're not finished with that conclusion.
If I could. So that what we have in Yankee is two major deviations from the law preceding it. One is the concept that because there was a jury instruction, which I concede there was, and some other cases that allude to it, that a lunatic is judged by some sort of objective standard. That was not the law, nor is it the law cited in many of the cases. And two, this particular injury requirement comes out of the woodwork from offhand statements made in other case law, when our law is clear from AE Investment, which is 62 Wisconsin 2nd 479, a party is negligent when he commits an act when some harm to someone is foreseeable. And I submit that in the prior case, and I'll take your question, but I have other cases that preceded that were not cited to the court, but the Dahlberg case at 232 Wis 6, the Bogus case at 10 Wisconsin 2nd 137, all these cases hold that, for example, in Bogus, they say the conclusion that the doctor hospital staff had reasonable grounds to anticipate or to take precautions against suicide or escape. There they held there was no liability, but the standard was not a particular injury standard. It was a standard of a person who needs protection.
It is there that I want to pause, because you're making the same point. Suicide or escape. What's the foreseeability? The chief has been pushing in questions, what is it that should be foreseeable? What is it you're asking? You make moment in your brief that the Court of Appeals missed the mark, that Ms. Hollander did not need to be protected so much because she was an elopement risk as because she was a danger to herself. Now, with that by way of preface, the jury instruction would answer the chief in this fashion. A hospital has the duty to restrain or guard a patient only if the employees knew or in the exercise of reasonable care should have known, that means foreseeability, the propensity of the patient to injure himself, herself, attempt to escape. That's the answer to the chief's question, the jury instruction.
That's in brackets, right?
Yes.
As if it's an alternative.
That's right.
To be chosen.
That's right. Are you advocating in your position a response different than what is set forth in the jury instruction as to what should be foreseeable?
Absolutely. I think a person who is hospitalized for their own safety on an involuntary basis, or for that matter, if they were going to switch her to voluntary, either way they weren't going to let her out, that they have a duty to watch her until they know otherwise.
Well, known the propensity of the patient to injure herself or attempt to escape. That's what you're advocating.
That's what she was hospitalized for. And this court in Yankee implicitly requires that some further proof come forward. Yeah. And I question why.
Well, under your theory then, or proposal, then the hospital basically is an insurer and they will be responsible for almost all injuries of this type, right?
No.
Then your argument is they failed in some, they were negligent, as you say in your brief, and therefore this is a fact issue.
I think the law should be two things. One is that the lunatic is not a negligent party, unless there's the lunatic led to the lunacy, as in Yankee, or the lunatic was not really a lunatic, which is, I think, clearly also in Yankee. I think the lunatic who's hospitalized is hospitalized for their own safety. The hospital owes a duty of due care. The hospital in this case is not willing to accept a normal duty of due care under AE Investment and the rest of the Wisconsin case law for the last 140 years. They want special rules. I say there should not be special rules when someone is there They were put on notice when the person was hospitalized, this person's a danger. Now, if that danger was removed, and there's a case on that, I think it's the Payne case, that was quoted in Yankee, but what was emphasized in Yankee was that the person, they have to be on notice of some additional harm, but it said, Payne also said, when the patient was ordered unattended, so that in a case, the hospital is not insured when the patient is, or the doctor says to the staff, this person's okay, we don't have to worry about this patient. Okay, now different rules apply. All we want is a duty of regular due care by the hospital without a bunch of rules that are different from every other tortfeasor.
You need one extra thing. You say there's a duty to take care of this person because the person's there because they can't take care of themselves, either for harm to themselves or harm to others. That's the general reason you're in there. And here you have negligence alleged. Negligence alleged would be, one, they weren't watching closely enough.
Yes.
Two, they didn't hear a 120-pound instrument fall to the floor.
Yes.
Three, they had an instrument that should have been more firmly attached. So at least you got three. You might have other things, but you got three. So you got negligence. I'll give you that. But you want more. You don't want contributory negligence to come in here because your position is, by law, somebody who is involuntarily institutionalized. I assume that is equal to lunatic. Is that
yes?
Okay. Someone who is involuntarily institutionalized because of danger is not to be gauged subjectively or objectively for negligence. Is that your position?
Yes.
So then you just have straight negligence. You have no comparative negligence, no contributory negligence, and you're home free. And it's not an insurer.
Right.
The hospital isn't an insurer because you can't. The hospital isn't going to pay unless it was negligent.
That's 100% right. And my position is that for 120 years, in the January 1883 term, a lunatic could not be held negligent, and it was never any other way except in the jury instructions until Yankee was decided.
Counsel, how do you reconcile that with your position on, what's the other case we're comparing Yankee with, the one that was just decided in 2000? In Yankee, I guess that's what we're talking about. How can you reconcile that? Excuse me. How can you reconcile that with the facts in Yankee, where Yankee was involuntarily committed? Isn't that correct?
Not for his own safety.
Okay, see, that's what you're saying. So you don't agree with the chief. You're saying only, you're saying people who are involuntarily committed can indeed be found to be negligent. They can be crazy, but they can be negligent as long as they are admitted because they might be a harm to others. You've made that distinction in your brief, and I don't understand it.
Well, let me divide it. I don't believe a lunatic can be held negligent under Wisconsin law until Yankee, and I think a reading of every case law, including Payne and others, says so.
Yankee has to be reversed.
Well, Yankee, I don't think, was a lunatic. I think that's the clear reading of Yankee. And also the court, I think, held that one of the reasons he was negligent is his own negligent acts led to his whatever lunacies he had. He didn't take his medication.
He was a Chapter 51 admittee in a mental institution.
Because he didn't take his medication. If he had taken his medication, all the experts, at least quoted in the Yankee decision, said he wouldn't have been there. So I think that the Yankee decision said when you fail to take steps that can prevent your mental illness while you're sane, those steps can be contributory negligent. And I agree with that. And that's why I don't think I'm disagreeing at all with the chief's questions. A lunatic under Wisconsin law cannot be held negligent if the person's really a lunatic. I think the whole discussion of the Yankee court, the facts went on for pages was that the evidence was clear that his planning was that not that of a lunatic, but of a sane person.
They may not have been an insurer, but in other words, what you're saying is that A, Hofflander could never be negligent. B, that if there's any negligence on the part of St. Catharines or Horizon, then, of course, we win. That's what you're saying, basically saying. And that in Yankee, the difference is there was no lunatic there.
There was no lunatic, and he was negligent for becoming hospitalized to begin with. But it's not an insurer, Justice Wilcox, because all I'm asking is that the hospital be judged by the same rules as every other tortfeasor. Good old, common, garden variety negligence.
Yeah, 1% or 99%.
There's plenty of situations where that occur. We allow that same comparison with a person underneath the age of 7. Why are we in 2002, almost 2003, effectively reversing the law that's existed in this state since 1883?
Well, because of perhaps the facts of this case, but I don't want to argue. I'm just listening to your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aiken. We've all listened carefully. We have a rebuttal. First, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I would like to speak very briefly on something that I'm quite concerned about, and that is what is meant by paragraph 93 of the Yankee decision. And I hope I'm not being bold, but I've had to try a case post-Yankee of a patient who took a running leap, ran through a room, dove off a bed into a wall, fracturing his neck. And all these issues came up, and we wrestled with them, as I can see the court is wrestling with them, as to what defines special relationship other than involuntarily committed. And I noticed that section 314A of the restatement talks not only to someone who's put in custody, but also one who voluntarily takes someone in. I think, as a trial lawyer, I need more guidance on what that means. Even more, there's a reference in paragraph 93 to height and duty. I think I know what it means, but it's nowhere spelled out. I think what it means is that as opposed to not having any duty at all to protect someone from themselves, that indeed if there's a heightened duty, it really is the duty as spelled out in Bogust and Dahlberg to exercise such ordinary care as the hospital knows or should know the patient's mental or physical condition requires. And lastly, in paragraph 93, it talks about that contributory negligence will again be in the picture if the exercise of care was not only reasonable, but also fully responsive to the heightened duty. I need more, at least I do, I can't speak for all trial lawyers, but the ones who are involved in my case, we wonder what does that mean. We need guidance on that. With respect to my specific rebuttal, I do believe the facts are not quite as robust as Mr. Hirschman would say and concluded today. I believe that given the principles of Yankee and the public policy, that if the court reverts to something other than what I perceive Yankee to be saying, it will put healthcare providers as insurers and with a greater chance of liability, it could engender a retreat to bars on windows, prison-like treatment, and other processes which impair the therapeutic relationship that mental health facilities are trying to engage in.
Do the facts of this case support the characterization of the plaintiff as a lunatic?
No, by no means. And I guess somebody has to explain. I think I'm understanding what Mr. Aiken is talking about a lunatic, and that's someone that...
Psychotic, you know, actively...
Yeah, someone that... Psychotic, or worse, that can't appreciate what's going on.
And that would put it within the exceptions to the ordinary care standard for self-care issues.
I believe it would.
So that's not what we're talking about here.
No, this is not a lunatic case.
Well, then are you not looking to a subjective standard, which the court rejected in Yankee?
Well, the court rejected that standard.
And you're not wanting, you don't want to put that in, do you? Treat everybody the same, reasonable person, not reasonably insane person, not reasonably lunatic person, not reasonably antisocial person, but reasonable normal person, whatever normal means.
Reasonable normal person, by all means. I've struggled with these issues.
No, don't we all, Mr. Yes. Nelson? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hughes.
Yes, Your Honor. And to pick up on Judge Sykes' point from just a moment ago, this is a woman who was in because she was a drug addict. She was
so
like...
Look at pages in the brief appendix of the plaintiffs. 173, 174, 172, and then the statement of emergency detention. Throughout that, I would not be exaggerating if I said 8 to 10 times it's written there's a concern that she's going to be suicidal.
Right.
So I find it a little difficult for you to say she's admitted because she's a drug addict when the statement of emergency detention says called family members and left message that she was killing herself tonight.
That?
And then the pages attached to it are paragraph after paragraph about her killing herself.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that was a manifestation of how she manifested her reaction to the drug she had ingested. And I don't mean to deny that's not a tragic situation, but she had ingested the drugs. She had ingested the illegal substances. She had a hand in her own condition coming about. As if, just like with Mr. Yankee, if he didn't take his medication, this woman took illegal substances, and that was the way she manifested it. It made her like that. And that was why when she was brought in, once the drugs were cleared out of her system, the physician found her no longer suicidal and removed her from those suicide precautions.
Apparently she was being treated by a psychologist who gave her the Prozac for suicide. Is that right?
She has had an intermittent history of being treated by some mental health clinics over a period of time before this. Yes, it was kind of an intermittent thing. It wasn't a steady course of treatment. But once the drugs were out of her system, once she was removed from suicide precautions, she was able to formulate and appreciate a rational plan. She appreciated the danger of falling. She tied the sheet. She appreciated the danger, her need for a coat. She appreciated her need for an accomplice, a means to get away once she got down to the ground. She appreciated a rational plan, and I see my red light.
Are you adopting the subjective standard or the objective standard, counsel?
The objective standard.
Good. Okay. Mr. Aiken, you have 5 minutes rebuttal. I don't quite understand that. I know you only took 25 of your minutes, but ordinarily respondents don't have rebuttal. Everybody seems to have conceded that, so you're going to get the last word. But I will call this the attention of the clerk's office.
Yeah, I think, Madam Justice, I don't have a time because no one discussed the issue that we were cross appellants on. And I think the order of the court was properly worded that I'm not to make a rebuttal unless somebody raised the JACO issue and Mr. Hirschman didn't discuss it and they didn't discuss it. Now the court is left barren on that.
So what are you going to discuss?
I just want to give the court a cite and a question, and I'll sit down. The site of pain is 81 Wisconsin 2nd, 264. And in that case, at page 274, It says, where an attending psychiatrist specifically ordered a suicidal patient to be unattended. Then they said, in the absence of some notice to the staff that a suicide attempt was imminent, the hospital, as a matter of law, was not negligent. So that I made comment, and I didn't get to finish, that the case, one of the cases upon which Yankee is based is Payne. But Payne had the psychiatrist do the opposite of what the psychiatrist did here, where he said, watch her closely. The last comment I had is in answer to the question, if we look at the prior case law, the guardianship of Meyer, the Karkoff case, those people were not any more crazy than Lori Hofflander. They weren't lunatics permanently in institutions. In fact, Karkoff was a man who burnt his house down and killed himself, and he was out in the outside world, so he was not a psychotic person.
Justice Stablish has a question.
You distinguished Yankee, among other means, by saying that Yankee had voluntarily omitted taking his own medication and therefore, while he was sane, had contributed to his own condition. Well, what's the difference here? I mean, in terms of real differences, because, as was just pointed out, Lori Hofflander contributed to her own condition by taking drugs. It sounds to me like that's two sides of the same coin.
There's two things. One, I agree that if while she was sane, she abused drugs, that evidence could come in as to her contributory negligence if that drug abuse was continuing to be a cause of her mental illness. My understanding of the disputed facts is that by the time of her elopement / suicide, whatever it really was, that the drugs were out of her system, they were no longer playing a role in her delusional state. But I think that indeed a person who is sane, who abuses drugs, that use could come in evidence as contributory negligence pre-hospital if it continues to be a substantial factor leading to the attempt. Secondly, I question if Lori, instead of tying the sheet around her ankle, had tied it around her neck, and she tied it too short, and we found her dangling by her neck. What would we do with her testimony if she said, well, I really wasn't trying to commit suicide, I was trying to escape, or she said, I wasn't trying to escape, I was trying to commit suicide? I think a person who is really mentally ill and in need of care needs it regardless of what they're trying to do. That's all I have.
Mr. Aiken, I have one question I want to clarify.
Thought I got away.
Assuming that there is a special relationship in some sort of a mental institution. Assuming that the person is committed because of, say, a suicide threat, does that mean that the institution is going to be responsible for any suicide that occurs, irrespective of how it's executed?
No, I would return the court to A Investment 62, Wisconsin 2nd. It was the hospital negligent in not reasonably preventing the suicide. So, for example, if the patient banged their head against the bedpost suddenly, unexpectedly, I would say that probably wasn't foreseeable. If the doctor says keep glass away from the patient, as it has happened here, and the patient slits their wrists, I would say that was foreseeable. I think it's that, again, all we really want is the hospital to be judged by the same standards as every other tortfeasor is, reasonable, ordinary, garden variety negligence. Could they foreseen it? And as you've heard today, the hospital's got some good arguments why they weren't negligent. Lori has some good arguments why they were. And that's what jury trials are all about. Who knows? Just like Schuster versus Altenburg, they may go back to the trial court and lose, just like I lost Schuster. But the question is what is the standards going to be applied? And I think it ought to be foreseeable harm to the patient. And if for example, in pain, if the doctor says, you don't have to watch her anymore, then I think that lets the hospital off the hook. But the opposite occurred here. And until, see, I think the problem is where the, who's got the proof here? They're the custodian. They have the custody not only of the patient, but of the evidence. And under Yankee, the plaintiff has to come forward and somehow show, God bless you, somehow show that there was more evidence of intent to harm. Whereas I think that it should be the reverse. The hospital should have to come forward and basically say, who would ever thunk it? Or we had additional evidence. We had a psychiatrist said, you don't have to worry about her anymore. Or we had a psychiatrist said, we'll let him out in an hour, just do the regular check and let the person out. That's different. But when the person's admitted for this very significant purpose, and a doctor says, watch her, I think that now we have a foreseeability of some harm. I don't care if it's elopement, suicide, in between, tie a rope around your neck and try to escape, tie it around your ankle and try to escape. Either way, we have a person who is mentally ill.
Thank you, Mr. Aiken.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson, Hughes, Wilson, and Aiken for good arguments on how complex the case. Thank you.